This is Once for All, where Jude 3 says, I found it necessary to write appealing to you to contend for the faith that was once for all delivered to the saints. Listen in as the faith held by believers of all times is now delivered to you.
Well, congratulations. You made it through the work week. And as it is our tradition on Fridays here on Once for All, taking a look at the news, you can join in at any time during today's broadcast by calling in toll free, no matter where you're listening. The toll free number is 1-844-51-FAITH, 1-844-51-FAITH. You'll also get your emails right here in the studio. The email address is deliveredonceforall@gmail.com, deliveredonceforall@gmail.com. I am your host, Pastor Evan Gigline, the pastor of Faith Lutheran Church in Rogue River, Oregon. And always with me on Fridays to discuss the items of the news is the multi-talented Jeff Smith. Jeff, welcome back.
Wow, that's a stretch, but I'm happy to be here.
Well, I don't know. I probably say this every week. I'm sure that I do, but a pretty interesting news week this week. You know, the tensions still rise on the domestic front, and we're still keeping an eye on all of that. I don't know if there's been a lot of new news on that front. We're just kind of seeing how things are going to, what's the next step? What's the next play here? And then, a lot of, especially as items that would be interesting for maybe the Christian listener, items of religious liberty. Here's something that just came out yesterday and kind of breaking this morning. A story. Did you hear about this? About the mother who was breastfeeding in a church and she was asked to leave. We had just touched on that topic before in another context, but this is an interesting thing. You know, we weren't slated to talk about this today, but you know. This is interesting to me on two accounts. I'm going to throw this at you, unexpected. But you know, mother is breastfeeding in a church, and she is asked to leave. Now, the details of this, it wasn't as if the church administration or the pastor came and said, "Please leave." But I think it was maybe a concerned church member who went up there, you know, so not necessarily representing the church itself, and you know, tried to help cover her up when that didn't work, you know, basically asked her to leave. But the laws that exist in some states to say, oh no, it's fine for a woman to be breastfeeding without cover. The argument is always that it's natural. So because it's natural, then we should, you know, maybe allow it. But I also wonder why a person, you know, urinating in public is also called indecent exposure. Is there a difference that you see there, Jeff?
Well, I'm going to be curious on your take on this from the religious perspective, because I think actually in this case that might be a little more pertinent. But I mean, I guess that the comparison that you make is it's a hard one. I mean, I don't know that you can equate the two of them, but they're both natural things that need to take place. And why is one accepted and one is the not? I get part of that is society has we've rallied around women and mothers, and for the last many, many, many years, there's been various pushes for women's rights, and of course, it gets taken into that, you know, abortion is a woman's right, which is debatable at the very least. But so I think this is more of a social construct than an actual problem or not a problem. And again, we've talked about this before on various subjects. Men and women are different. And yes, breastfeeding is a natural thing, and I don't necessarily have a problem with it. The problem I have is we tend to ignore the differences between men and women, and there's a lot of men out there that are gonna leer at a woman that's breastfeeding because he can see her breasts. You know, some of us can say, well, that there's nothing sexy about that. Well, that's not for me to decide. The the man that's looking at her is deciding that she is, and that's all that really matters. Now, if she's still comfortable with that, I don't have a problem with her breastfeeding in public, but to ignore the nature of man, to me, presents a problem. And again, I think what my, I don't know if it's a solution, but the way I think it should be handled is, I think that there's nothing unreasonable about a woman when she's in public, you know, doing her best to cover up and not in shame, just in common decency, the same way that I'm not going to, you know, walk over to the side of the church and relieve myself on the tree. That's a little bit of a crude comparison, but they're both natural things that have to happen. And
in the face of the "it's natural, so we should allow it" argument, I think it's a fair parallel.
Yeah, I think you're right. And again, why is it, to me, it is objectionable for me to be seen urinating on a tree or whatever out in public. So why isn't this natural thing that exposes, you know, part of the woman, why is that different? I don't know, and I'm not saying it's not different, but I don't see the difference, and I think there can be a compromise there. But I'm not a breastfeeding woman, so it's hard for me to say definitively that, well, yes, I should cover myself up. But again, in the other part of the scenario we're talking about, I absolutely don't, you know, make it. And I'm a landscaper. I work outside. And do I need to go out, you know, use the restroom outside on an occasion? Yeah, it's pretty rare now that I have a little better setup for my equipment and I can go into my trailer and have privacy. But it happens all the time. But you try and be as discreet as possible. And, mm-hmm. and I think, at least to a certain extent, the same thing applies here.
Yeah. The other interesting dynamic in all of this is perhaps a way that churches are viewed today. I just came back from a pastor's conference, and we were talking about this, that in our church tradition, the Lutheran Church Missouri Synod, we practice something called closed communion, and that is the idea that when people commune at our altar, they are saying that I am one with your belief, I agree with you doctrinally. And this is outside of the realm of commodity and retail, where you walk into a store and the store needs to satisfy the customer. And someone comes to church, and if they haven't yet been taught what we believe, or they don't agree with what we believe, we're not making a judgment on their faith, but we're saying that if you commune here, you're saying what you believe is what we believe, and if you don't believe that, then you don't partake in this Lord's Supper. And one of the pastors I was talking to recently, practiced this in a way that we normally do. If you don't believe what we believe, then you can't take the Lord's Supper with us yet until you come to that belief. And so this angered a gentleman that visited his church. And what did he do? He went and wrote a Yelp review about, you know, how unfriendly this church is.
Well, that's how I pick my churches. So
on Yelp, yeah, of course. Who doesn't? But but I think what that showed us was the mentality that a church here exists to cater to all of my needs. And this is really a novel American concept, where really the church exists to give you what you need, not to accommodate what your perceived needs are. There is sometimes a difference. And I think one of the interesting dynamics here is the nursing mother had the perspective of the church that if you aren't meeting, you know, my quote felt needs, then I am going to leave this place because you're not the church for me. It's just we've taken the retail commerce mentality and brought it into the church and expect the church to meet us on the consumer level now.
Yeah, and it's interesting that you mentioned that, because I think as you know, you and I are friends, and I for many years have, I guess you could say, I've been on a bit of a religious seeking, so to speak. And it's always been one of the things that bothered me. And one of the most upfront examples of that that I've seen over, I don't know, let's say the last 20 years. And it's probably been going on for more than that, but I've been aware of it for that long, is the movement in the American Catholic Church. And the reason I bring them up is because they're the most visible. That's the most talked about in the media and whatever. But there's been a big movement of people in the American Catholic Church that want the church to bend to what to their beliefs. And I've always said, if you don't believe what they're teaching, go find another church. Mm-hmm. You're in the wrong place. And which is a big part of my, you know, my journey, that, you know, there's some things with churches I've been to that I'm not comfortable with. I don't continue. Now, in a way, it's a little disingenuous, even on my part, because I don't get to decide what the gospel is. The Bible decides that. Mm-hmm. But I try not to be making that decision. But if I feel like that the church that I'm attending, and I've attended some different churches with my wife, if they're straying from that, from what I believe is being taught in the Bible, then I know I'm not in the right place. The other curiosity I would have from your perspective is, I think that even though this church, this woman went into this church, it, technically it's a private place, but a church is like a business. They get to decide what the, you know, how they treat people in their business, quote unquote.
Mm-hmm.
I would think, and I would love to hear your thoughts on it, this goes all the way back to Adam and Eve, and the fact that when Adam and Eve were created, there was no shame, but immediately that changed. And I wonder, does this have anything to do even with that, as far as how the church should handle it?
That's an interesting perspective. Now, earlier when we were talking about whether this mother, or the hypothetical breastfeeding mother, whether she should cover or not, you said that we should not, because of shame. In other words, we're not trying to, you know, say that this is a shameful thing, like, you know, get that disgusting activity away from me. That's not what we're saying. I think where this has really come from is we do, and this is a Christian idea, this is a churchly idea, that we do want to uphold the great value of mothers and children. Particularly in a day and age where children are despised, and quite frankly, where children are aborted and killed, it's great to emphasize the importance of mothers and children. But I also think that there is a place to talk about decency. And I think that's where the shame question comes in. So I think we want to make the distinction when we talk about shame, that the idea of shame is not that the activity itself is shameful, but that that we would want to cover our bodies in modesty for the sake of decency, and that that my body would be reserved for my spouse, and my spouse's body would be reserved for me, and that's not just in the sexual activity or intimacy, but also in what the body that is viewed. And so I think from a Christian perspective, we want to think of terms of the body for, this is an interesting thing that Paul says in 1 Corinthians, where he says that your body is not your own. So the husband's body is the wife's, and the wife's body is the husband. Where this says that Paul says not to, that's Ephesians, by the way, not 1 Corinthians, but 1 Corinthians says that that husband and wife ought not to withhold themselves from each other, except for maybe for a time of fasting, and then come together again. So that the argument is that the institution of marriage has been the place of giving each other's bodies over. And I think exposing then the body in ways, even though we're admitting this isn't a sexual activity, you made a great point that I can't discern what another person views as sexual or not, and every peeping Tom proves that point. You know, who puts, you know, the perverts who put like cameras in bathrooms, you know, that exists, unfortunately. And so I think you made a great argument with the concern for other people and how they would interpret a natural activity to pervert it into something you know, sexual, unfortunately.
Yeah, and I always hear the argument, well, men can go around without their shirts, but women can't. Well, there's a couple of things I would say about that. First of all, they can, I guess. Society accepts that. But most of the time I see a guy without his shirt, I'm like, dude, put a shirt on.
Yeah.
Don't want to see that. Not for any sexual reason, but just because most guys don't look too good without their shirt on. But the
you
other thing
seen
is
me, it, Jeff.
Yeah. Yeah.
threw you on that one.
But the other thing would be, again, we can't ignore the difference between men and women, and men see breasts sexually, not, and women don't see a man without his shirt. I mean, they may have sexual feelings, but the men's physique is maybe attractive to some women, but I don't think it has the same, you know, the same effect on a woman that a woman's breast does on a man. And again, in society, we've gotten to this point where we just want to ignore all the differences between men and women. I mean, you go on Facebook, you have a choice of like infinite numbers of genders to choose from. So we've just completely disregarded the science and the fact that there's differences between men and women. But, you know, it's not an easy thing. And I think in this case with the church, it's up to that individual church. It's a private place. They get to decide.
Yeah.
But it's an interesting conversation nonetheless.
Yeah, usually you see the sign that says no shirt, no shoes, no service. Recently I walked into a store and the sign said no shirt, no shoes, no pants, no service, which I thought it's interesting. Now we have to stipulate, by the way, wear pants when you come into the store. We're going to take a break and be right back. When we get back for this break, we're going to be talking about lethal injections in Arkansas, religious liberty in Missouri, about Trinity Lutheran Church who bought some or wanted to get some tires from the state for their playground. This is going to be the first major case that Neil Gorsuch, the new Supreme Court justice, hears. Also, what's the relationship between the Democratic Party and the abortion issue? All that after this, you're listening to Once for All.
The phone lines are now open. Call toll-free 1-844-51-FAITH. That's 1-844-51-FAITH.
This is Life Issues with Brad Mattis, president of Life Issues Institute.
Earlier, I've talked about the controversial three-parent human embryo scientists are generating in laboratories. The child has already been born through this reckless process. I say reckless because top researchers have said the team who conceived this child was lucky the baby is healthy. 75% of the time, the embryo's DNA is seriously flawed. And of course, those tiny humans are being killed. I don't believe in luck, and these people are playing Russian roulette with human life. Just because technology allows them to generate humans with three parents doesn't mean we should ignore biblical principles with breakneck speed. When God instituted marriage, he said, the two will become one flesh. Children are to be a blessing, not an experiment.
Like us on Facebook at Life Issues and stay informed, more informed than you've ever been.
Today's Takedown Minute, CFW Walther throws down against the notion that doctrine is irrelevant for preaching. He says, I wish to talk the Christian doctrine into your very heart, enabling you to come forward as living witnesses with a demonstration of the Spirit and of power. I do not want you to be standing in your pulpits like lifeless statues, but to speak with confidence and cheerful courage, offering help where help is needed. Now, of all doctrines, the first and foremost is the doctrine of justification. However, immediately following upon it, and almost equally as important, is the doctrine of how to distinguish between law and gospel. Let us now focus on this distinction between law and gospel, a task to which we want to apply ourselves diligently. Luther says that the man who possesses the skill of distinguishing law and gospel is foremost among his peers and should be regarded as a doctor of theology. That was CFW Walther for today's Takedown Minute.
With the SRN News Business Brief, I'm Dennis Crowley. A Kentucky doctor who was dragged off a United flight after he refused to give up his seat has reached a settlement with the airline for an undisclosed amount. David Dow's legal team announced the settlement in a brief statement. The agreement includes a provision that the amount will remain confidential. President Trump says leaders of Canada and Mexico have called him asking that the United States remain a partner in the North American Free Trade Agreement. The president says he has agreed. The president says his response was subject to the fact that if a fair deal is not reached, the administration will then terminate NAFTA. Toyota is recalling about 250,000 small pickup trucks, mainly in North America, because the rear wheels have the potential to lock up, causing drivers to lose control. On Wall Street, the Dow added 6 points. With business, I'm Dennis Crowley.
Welcome back to Once for All, talking about the news items of the week. And among those stories is a story about Arkansas, who has... this is interesting what has brought about the topic. Okay, so I think this country for a long time has debated the value of capital punishment. That's nothing new. But what has brought in the news this week is that Arkansas has the drugs that they use to implement lethal injection, and these drugs have an expiration date. And, you know, it's kind of like... the expiration date on the milk starts getting close. So you start drinking more milk. Well, we better start doing some more executions because the drug is about to expire. Let's hear the story from NBC Today, and then we'll talk about it here.
Arkansas has been in a rush to carry out a series of executions before the end of the month when the potency of one of the drugs used in the process expires. The state planned to execute 2 death row inmates last night. The court spared one man, but the other was pronounced dead at 11:56 p.m. after the Supreme Court rejected the last-minute appeals. It was the state's first execution since 2005, one that state officials said was necessary because a drug used for lethal injections is about to expire. Convicted murderer Liddell Lee was put to death just before midnight Arkansas time after the state and U.S. Supreme Courts denied efforts to stop his execution. Lee's death followed last-minute legal battles between his defense team and lawyers for the state of Arkansas over the state's right to use the drug midazolam as part of its lethal injection process. Lee, who was 51, was sentenced to death in 1995 in Pulaski County, Arkansas, for the murder of 26-year-old Deborah Reese. He had maintained his innocence. Arkansas originally sought to execute Lee and 7 other men convicted of different murders decades ago over an 11-day period because its supply of midazolam expires April 30th. Drug companies also said their products were not intended for use in executions.
This is significant because at no point in modern American history has any state ever attempted to carry out so many executions in such a short period of time.
As usual in these last-minute appeals, the U.S. Supreme Court did not explain why it rejected them on a 5-4 vote. But one of the dissenters, Justice Stephen Breyer, said the state's rush to use midazolam as the reason for determining who will be executed and who will not is, quote, close to random.
Hello today.
So there's a lot of dynamics to this story. The first one, well, maybe not the first in priority, but one of them is the fact that now we have 9 justices again. And so this probably would have ended in a tie otherwise. And now normally when you have a case going through the court system, the lower court decision stands. And I'm not sure what that decision was in this case. I think it was in favor of the state, but I don't know that for sure. So I don't know how a tie would have been assessed there. So that's interesting that we have a full bench in the Supreme Court. I'd like to talk, you know, in a moment about just the aspect of capital punishment. But in this case, what's interesting is not just that lethal injections are going on, but the reason that they're going on in rapid fire here. What are your thoughts on this, Jeff?
Yeah, I'm definitely pro capital punishment, and we can talk about that a little bit more. But in this specific case, I actually find this a little bit troubling, and the reason for it, or at least the reason that they're using, is the excuse to get these executions on the fast track is because this drug is going to expire and the company doesn't want to sell them more of it because they don't want them using it for lethal injections. And I've got a couple of things that you know, can play into this. But I mean, I think about a couple of drugs that I take, like this time of year, I'm taking allergy medication, and I have, you know, I take a pill twice a day for pretty severe acid reflux. And this is akin to, well, my allergy medicine is going to expire next month, and I'll just start doing, you know, double doses every day so I don't waste it or something. It doesn't make any sense, and it's probably harmful to myself. Now, in the case of executions, that's kind of the point. It's harmful to the person you're giving it to so that you can hasten their death. But this not only do I not like what they're doing here and trying to rush things and get this done quickly, but I wonder if it's doing any good for people that are for the death penalty and would like to see it more widely used. I'm not sure they're doing any favors to the argument that the death penalty should be a deterrent. Right at this moment, it feels like a deterrent, at least to the people in Arkansas. But I don't know that I agree with this rush to get this done. It almost seems a little creepy to me.
Yeah, I caught I told you at the conference this week in the hotel, just caught a little snippet of a show, and I wish I could have recorded it. You know, one of those moments, like, oh, if I could just reverse record somehow, then that would be great. But fascinating discussion about the story. So apparently one of them was described as a botched, which I don't know that was actually true, that it was a botched lethal injection, because in the end, the person did actually die. But I think typically lethal injection is supposed to be kind of a quick, painless death. And then one of the cases from Arkansas, it was, you know, 20 minutes where the person, they didn't die immediately as they were supposed to. And one of them was morbidly obese. I think that may be a contributing factor in this. But in any case, the commentary that I caught just a snippet of was saying that, well, how is this even justice? You know, here you have, you know, yeah, these people did, you know, heinous crimes, but now they, you know, suffer on a table for 20 minutes and then they die. How is that justice? And that's a fascinating question to me. And it wasn't an honest question. Just, she was actually suggesting that it wasn't justice. But it's kind of, from, again, a biblical worldview, the demand for the punishment in sin has always been death. Like, that's what is required of one who transgresses. And in a from a man to God relationship now, but from a man to man relationship, if someone kills another person, what do we require of that person for the sake of justice? And this is where the biblical idea of eye for an eye, tooth for a tooth comes from. Now, it's interesting because Jesus later says, you know, you've heard it said, eye for an eye, a tooth for a tooth, but I say to you, turn the other cheek. And what is being said there is Jesus, it came to be that if I was sinned against, I have the right to seek the same amount of retribution. But they would exasperate. So if you stole my bike, then I would, you know, cut off your hand or something like that. Now, obviously, that's not an equal punishment.
Seems reasonable.
So what eye for an eye, tooth for a tooth brought about for Israel was to limit the amount of punishment that can be brought about for a crime. So if you stole someone's sheep, you couldn't cut off their hands, but you could take a sheep from them. And so there was an equality. This is actually the idea in justice, that it says that the punishment must fit the crime. So you don't get thrown in jail for 20 years for stealing a piece of bubble gum. You know, we want equality. So actually, to say, how is it justice if this person committed murder, the very thing that would be required of him would be his life? That's actually the answer's in the question. What do you think about that?
Well, It's a hard one to look at because one of the things, and this is going to be a completely disingenuous argument, and I'm gonna use it anyhow, knowing that it is. There's some alternatives we can have to the death penalty. We could have Sharia law, which would actually call for the death penalty in some cases, but. And it's a funny because it's a non-argument in one respect, but in another respect, a lot of the same people that would tell us we shouldn't have the death penalty would also be the ones that are fighting for the rights of Muslim members of the community to be, you know, not be looked at as terrorists or whatever and all of that, but they refuse to look at what their religion calls for. And, you know, so the same people that are calling for gay rights are also calling for Muslim rights and don't realize that if they get those Muslim rights, they're going to get thrown off a roof. So my argument is a little disingenuous, but it also points out how disingenuous the argument is on the other side. So again, I don't know that our society would be comfortable with a true eye for an eye and a tooth for a tooth, because if they really wanted that, these executions would be a lot less humane than they are now, because we would say, well, whatever you did to your victim, we're going to do to you. And, you know, if a couple of these guys suffer for, even 20 minutes is the example that you gave, it makes us feel uncomfortable, but is it really all that bad? I don't think so. I think that if we're going to stand behind this form of punishment, if you want to call it that, you have to be comfortable with the fact that they might suffer a little bit. What did they do to their victim? I mean, is it really equivalent to say, oh, we can't do this because they may suffer a little bit? On the other side of that, though, I would say that why is it that we have so much trouble with this? We put down pets every day in this country, all over, and it's very rare you hear a case where somebody's at their vet and they're mortified by how their dog suffered or whatever. Now, not everybody watches the act putting them down, but a lot of people do, and they don't have any trouble with it. I don't understand. We have laws for people to commit suicide themselves. We have states that are sponsoring suicide, and they use drugs for that. So use the same drugs. And if it takes 20 minutes to kill the guy, so be it. But if it's okay for someone to take their own life with drugs that the state says, yeah, these are fine, okay, then give those same drugs to the executioner. I don't really get where the problem is. I understand some people are against capital punishment, but the suffering argument to me is a non-starter.
It's very fascinating because we have arguments on two sides. So usually the argument that you hear that, you know, if you're so pro-life talking about the abortion issue, then you ought to be pro-life talking about the death penalty issue. And I'll first take just a constitutional approach to this. The Constitution doesn't necessarily say that, you know, so we have life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness, and the Constitution doesn't say those things can't be taken away. It just says that those things can't be taken away without due process. And so what you're doing on the front end of life with abortion is you're taking away the life of a human being without due process. In other words, let's put these little babies on trial and see what crimes they've committed. But when a person has received due process, they've received a fair trial through the a speedy trial, a jury of their peers, all the things that we have in our criminal justice system. And I have to say, in our criminal justice system, the odds are tilted in the defendant's favor. We, as Americans, we would rather let some people get away with it than to execute some innocent people. Now, I'm sure in the history of the United States, there have been people who may have been executed. Who knows? I don't know. Maybe those stats are probably out there. But there's the appeals process. I mean, it takes a long time to actually get to it. So from a constitutional perspective, look, there is due process, and we want to look at that. Now, from a scriptural perspective, and I know I want to get to these other stories here, too. You know, Romans chapter 13 actually tells us that the role of the government is to be a avenger for God. So Romans 13 will say, the government is God's servant for your good, but if you do wrong, be afraid, for he, the government, does not bear the sword in vain, for it is a servant of God, an avenger who carries out God's wrath on the wrongdoer. So according to Romans 13, when the government would execute a criminal, the government is being God's servant to bring about wrath to those who do wrong. So the basic argument that Romans 13 says is then don't do wrong, do good. You know, don't kill people and you won't have to worry about it.
Yeah, and that seems like a reasonable argument to me that and again, I don't that's maybe the one uncomfortable thing about the death penalty is that we know that occasionally we may get it wrong. So yeah, you have to be comfortable with that, and I, you know, as hard of a decision as that is, I'm comfortable with that because ultimately it's God's judgment that will matter in the end, and I don't know. It's a hard thing because it's a legitimate argument to say, you know, we might put someone to death that's not guilty, but is that a strong enough argument to just abolish capital punishment altogether? I don't feel like it is, but
I mean, again, we don't have a perfect system, but we have a great system, in my opinion. Again, the standard, if you're on trial for, you know, capital punishment, is did the jury assess, did this person do it beyond reasonable doubt? So it's very possible that a jury could decide, you know, together as a body, this person probably did it, but I have reasonable doubt, so we're going to, you know, render him not guilty. For the purpose that, even though he probably did it, if there isn't enough hard evidence to say that he did it beyond reasonable doubt, then we'd rather let that guy go, you know?
Yeah, O.J. Simpson.
Yeah, right. So again, I think that this is these are the safeguards to help us in this. Again, no system is perfect, but I think we have a great system. We need another break already. Time flies. And then when we get back, I think we'll talk about this story about the relationship between the abortion issue and the Democratic Party. That after this, you're listening to Once for All.
The phone lines are now open. Call toll-free 1-844-51-FAITH. That's 1-844-51-FAITH.
And now it's time for Table Talk Extras with Pastor Brian Wolfmuller.
Faith and love are really two exactly opposite things. We can think of it like this. Love is what gives. The Bible says, for God so loved the world that he gave. We know what comes next. Give. Love gives. Jesus says, no greater love is man than this, than that he lay down his life for his friend, that he give his life for his neighbors, for his friend. Love is always giving, serving, dying even to give and to serve. Faith, on the other hand, receives. Faith is at the getting into the gift. Faith is what says, thank you very much for this. So the Lord loves us in Christ. And by faith, we receive or take hold of that love that he gives to us. Now, we always confuse it. We want to have faith in our neighbor and love toward God. We want to receive things from our neighbor, justice and fairness and good treatment and all this sort of thing. And we want to then show our love and gratitude to God as if he is poor and he needs the things that we have to give. But that's reversing the way that God would have it. His love gives to us marvelous benefits, blessings, beyond our asking or even our imagination. We have faith towards God who gives us these things. And then we have love towards our neighbor. as we share the gifts that God has given us, the gifts of love and life and forgiveness, as we share those with the neighbor who God has given as well, so we live as Luther learned from the scriptures, in faith toward God and in love toward the neighbor. May God keep us properly ordered in this life and even in the life to come.
Amen. This has been a production of Table Talk Radio. For more information, visit tabletalkradio.org.
This is Sacred Meditations. Almighty God, by our baptism into the death and resurrection of your Son, Jesus Christ, you turn us from the old life of sin. Grant that we, being reborn to new life in Him, may live in righteousness and holiness all our days. Through Jesus Christ, our Lord, who lives and reigns with you and the Holy Spirit, one God, now and forever. Amen. Learning to pray by actually praying, this is sacredmeditations.org. Thank you for making Sacred Meditations part of your day.
With SRN Sports, I'm Michael Harrington. Let's start with the NFL Draft. Round one began last night. The Cleveland Browns went first overall and took Texas A&M defensive end Myles Garrett. He's the first Aggie ever to be taken number one overall in the NFL Draft. The Bears moved up to slot number two and grabbed junior quarterback Mitch Trubisky of North Carolina. He says he's ready to learn.
I've been told that Mike Glenn's a starter. That's what Mr. Pace said when he brought him in, and I look forward to going in there and competing as always. Everywhere I've been my whole life, I've been a competitor, and I'm just going to go in there and compete, and I'm going to learn from the guys and help them as well. So it's all about helping the Chicago Bears organization win. That's all that matters.
The San Francisco 49ers went third, taking sophomore defensive end Solomon Thomas of nearby Stanford. Kansas City moved up 17 spots to come away with Texas Tech quarterback Patrick Mahomes with the 10th pick. Two-time Heisman Trophy finalist Clemson quarterback Deshaun Watson, 12th overall to the Texans. This is SRN Sports.
Welcome back to Once for All. Well, you know, it's an interesting dynamic that we're in the political climate. I think, you know, anyone in the last 10 years or so has seen, I think, I don't know what you think, and this is your side of the program, so I think we've seen a greater divide amongst the American people politically than we've seen in years past. And, of course, some of the issues that have characterized the Democratic Party, whether they like it or not, are how they take those social issues, the things like abortion, the things like the SOGI laws, and all that goes with that. But there's much more to the Democratic Party than there is just the social issues. In fact, what if you're the kind of person who says, yeah, I don't think that we need to be redefining gender. I don't even need to be letting people go into other people's bathrooms. I think that we should support a child's life even prenatally while they're in the womb. But what if such a person has those views and wants to advocate for more, government control, or certain views on education, certain views on spending. These are some views that are typically held by the political left, but the Democratic Party has put people in an awkward position where if they want to have such views that are typically left leaning, then they have to also accept the left leaning social issues. And this was an interesting little exchange that was found on Meet the Press with Nancy Pelosi. Let's listen in, and then we'll talk about this after the clip.
What should unify the Democratic Party? What should make somebody a Democrat and not a Democrat? And I ask it in this way. There's been a lot of back and forth, especially among abortion rights activists, about a decision of the Democratic Party to support a candidate for mayor in Omaha, a Democrat, who happens to be pro-life. And there are some that, and at some point, the Democratic National Committee chairman actually had to put out the following statement after 3 days of back and forth. He said, I fundamentally disagree with Heath Mello's personal beliefs, the candidate for Omaha mayor, about women's reproductive health. It is a promising step that the candidate now shares the Democratic Party's position on women's fundamental rights. Each candidate who runs as a Democrat should do the same, because every woman should be able to make her own health choices, period. Can you be
you
a Democrat?
Why don't you interview Tom Perez?
Let me ask you this.
Nate.
But can you be a Democrat and the support of the Democratic Party if you're pro-life?
Of course. Of course. I have served for many years in Congress with members who have not shared my very positive, my family would say, aggressive position on promoting a woman's right to choose. But what you asked at the first part of the question before you went off was about what unifies Democrats. And what unifies, people say to me all the time, oh, you do such a good job unifying the House Democrats. I say, I don't. Our values unify us. We are unified with our commitment to America's working families, about job creation, about budget policies that invest in the future, good-paying jobs. And that's what we'd like to see a debate on vis-a-vis the President of the United States. He promised jobs. Right. Show us the jobs. Where's his infrastructure bill? There are many promises made, right. Promises broken. And here's the thing. Right. Where's the infrastructure bill? The president was supposed to have a strong infrastructure bill coming in. The infrastructure bill is one of the biggest secrets in Washington, D.C., second only to the president's not showing us his tax returns. We need to see those so we can see how his tax policy will affect his own tax situation. We need to see them so we can see what is the hold that the Russians have on him politically, financially, and personally.
Let me.
So somehow the question on what unifies Democrats gets to the point Donald Trump hasn't shown us his tax return. So I didn't quite catch that connection, but Jeff, you can explain that to me.
Well, actually, I think she's on to something there. That is what unifies the Democrats. What is today's way of hating on Donald Trump? One day it's the Russians, another day it's his taxes and whatever happened, you know, whatever the media decides to talk about. Not unusual, and we've talked about this. She didn't really answer the question, but I find it amusing when she mentioned that she was asked about, or she was said, oh, it's great how you unify the party, and she's like, I don't. Our values do, and I'm not sure values would be the right word.
I wrote that down too.
I think they're goose stepping is what unifies their party. They're willing to goose step on every single issue, and your personal beliefs and your even if you think the Constitution doesn't support your beliefs, if the Democrat Party says this is what we're in lockstep on, you're supposed to fall in line. And I mean, that comment from Tom Perez, it showed that. I mean, he tried to be diplomatic in it. I mean, he didn't swear at him, which is what he's been doing a lot lately. But he basically just said, well, we're going to drag him over to our side. We're glad he's with us on some other things, but you know, we need to beat him over the head a couple more times, and then he'll be lockstep with us. And that's really what the Democrat Party has become. Now, to their credit, it serves them well as far as there's never any dissension. But I'm not sure that's a healthy way to govern. You know, your members should be able to stand up for things that they believe in. I look at the example of Tommy Lahren and Glenn Beck. I think Glenn Beck took the wrong approach with that. Why can't we accept someone who's so strong on her beliefs to be, you know, on a social issue? Now, abortion's an important social issue. But if she wants to be pro-choice, I don't think we toss her into the sea with the tea, you know. Mm-hmm. And so I think he took the wrong approach there. But in general, that's the difference between the Republican Party and the Democrat Party. The Republicans have all different views. They're all over the map.
Right.
It's not a unifying way to be, but it's a genuine way to be. And the Democrats, I don't think, are genuine. I think they expect you to be lockstep, you know, goose-stepping like a North Korean soldier.
Hmm. Now, the story we just heard from Meet the Press was on the topic of abortion. I want to maybe push this a little bit to think about the SOGI laws, the sexual orientation and gender identity laws, because you know, those who are pushing for such laws and non-discrimination, things like that, they're looking to the Democratic Party to get these things done, or at least, you know, left-leaning judges, you know, one of those things. But I wonder if the Democratic Party wouldn't be painting themselves into a corner because, I mean, yeah, that's kind of a, you could say, a progressive agenda, but it isn't necessarily value, since the Democratic Party is united by value. It's not necessarily a value that's shared by all the Democrats. And again, if you're just the kind of person who, you know, doesn't, you know, want to redefine marriage, doesn't want to redefine, you know, what gender is, you know, thinks that basically when you're born, you're given a sex and that's what it is. And yet you want to have some typical left thoughts on economy, on education, on fiscal spending, role of government. Where are you supposed to go? You know, you don't want to necessarily further the agendas of the sexual revolution, but you also don't really find safe haven with the Republicans. So I wonder if the Democrats aren't ostracizing some of their base because they don't want to be furthering this sexual revolution agenda.
Yeah, and that's where the problem comes with the difference I talked about with them always being lockstep is when you don't have some differing views within the party, it's exactly what you said it was. They've painted themselves into this corner. And the perfect example I would use is I dispute the actual science behind the global warming claims. Not that we can't occasionally have warming or cooling, and not even that, you know, certain things that we do may have effects on the environment. And then, of course, that argument gets conflated with pollution. I always see these arguments going on Facebook, and you see all these ones, pollution, pollution, pollution. These are not the same thing. The fact that we got rid of CFCs to clean the air, that's pollution. Whether or not we're causing global warming is a lot bigger than pollution.
Right.
But having said that, I get called a science denier because I'm not in lockstep with the, you know, man-made global warming claims, yet they'll stand for every 59 genders that Facebook gives you the choice of. There's no science to back that up. So who's the science denier? So it's exactly what you've said. They painted themselves in this corner because their arguments are working against themselves. They on one hand, you know, on the global warming conversation, want to call you a science denier, but then on so many things that they stand for, they're doing just that. They're science deniers. There's no science to back up 59 genders. That's a social construct. It's fine if we want to have that social construct. I don't care for it, but if people decide that that's the social construct they want to have, go at it. That's great. Have 59 genders. But there's no science to back that up. So they definitely, that the term you used is perfect. They paint themselves in a corner because they don't leave any room for adjustments.
Just about 30 seconds for an answer. Do you think that played a role in the general election, why Hillary Clinton didn't get elected?
I think it does. I think it's part of the reason that Bernie Sanders was as popular as he was. And I think it's the reason that there's some, you know, some ambiguity in the French election. People are tired of being told what to think. They're being tired of being told it's our way or the highway. They're tired of, you know, governments that don't function. And a lot of the reasons they don't function, they see is because of things like this.
All right. Well, that's going to be all the time we have. Jeff, thanks for coming in again.
Thanks for having me.
And if you miss any part of today's broadcast, just catch us over at onceforallradio.com. Over there, you can listen to any of our past episodes. And always great to have you with us, and have a wonderful weekend. We'll talk to you again on Monday on Once for All.
This has been Once for All. You can contact the show by sending an email, delivered onceforall@gmail.com. You can listen again to this show or any other episodes by visiting onceforallradio.com. Until next time, stand firm in the faith, once delivered to the saints.